I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Outlier Podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Conlon, and it's Friday, April 5th, and there was an earthquake this morning in New York City. The epicenter was in New Jersey, Lebanon, New Jersey, to be exact. It was about a 4.8. That is what Fox News is reporting. And I'm told that people in Connecticut and Massachusetts could also feel it. It's crazy because I live on a first floor apartment in New York City, and I definitely thought that there was some kind of subway accident underneath me. I completely freaked out and I called my kids' school. I was just totally a mess. And actually, something that's pissing me off right now, as it's been a few hours and their school still hasn't sent an email. That's very, very annoying. Luckily, I called, I emailed, and all is well. So I hope that's not a sign of anything that's to come. I mean, I know there's a big solar eclipse on Monday. Should I be scared? Should we all be scared? Who the hell knows? Let's pray not. But okay, I have not done an episode on the Officer John O'Keefe case since March 18th. And on March 18th, I did an episode with Joe Jackalone, aka the Sarge, a former NYPD sergeant. And I took a breather just to cover some other missing persons cases. Oh my gosh, I don't know if it's just me and I'm just paying more attention to the news and to what's going on in the world, but I do feel like there are just a lot more missing people popping up, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. But let's get to some Karen Reed trial updates and my guest for today. So the defense motion to dismiss was denied on March 26th, and I wasn't surprised, but something interesting that I thought came out of that hearing was the prosecution filing this buffer zone motion. And the buffer zone motion was ruled on yesterday, which was April 4th, by Judge Cannone. And I'm going to read this to you. And initially, they wanted people at least 500 feet away with signs and clothing that said Free Karen Reed. And Judge Cannone during the hearing said, you know, 500 feet is a little excessive. So she ruled on 200 feet. And the memorandum states, quote, "It is ordered that no individual may demonstrate in any manner, including carrying signs or placards, within 200 feet of the courthouse complex during trial unless otherwise ordered by this court. This complex includes the Norfolk Superior Courthouse Building and the parking area behind the Norfolk County Registry of Deeds Building. Individuals are also prohibited from using audio-enhancing devices while protesting. It is further ordered that no individuals will be permitted to wear or exhibit any buttons, photograph, clothing, or anything related to the case pending against the defendant or relating to any trial participant in the courthouse during the trial. Law enforcement officers who are testifying or are members of the audience are also prohibited from wearing their department uniforms or any police emblems in the courthouse. End quote. Interesting. So my first thought here was the Derek Chauvin murder trial, who was convicted of murdering George Floyd. Now, if you recall, people were outside holding signs that Derek Chauvin was a murderer. There were pictures. It was graphic. It was crazy. And these pictures, they look to be close enough. I don't know exactly how many feet away from the courthouse they were, but I did call his defense attorney's office this morning to ask them about this, and the person that answered basically sent me to the attorney's voicemail. They haven't called me back yet, but I would just be really interested to know if they filed anything, because I would think that if that was my client that was on trial for murder and people are outside claiming that my client was a murderer, I don't think I would necessarily want the jury to see that. So I would just be interested to know if anything was done about that. And if not, man, what a big difference. And I'll quickly point out something that was discussed at the hearing before they spoke about the buffer zone is Canone asked the prosecution if they had an update on the DNA testing of the hair sample of Officer John O'Keefe. And the prosecution said they had a partial profile, but the full profile wouldn't be available until after April 16th, when the trial is scheduled. And he asked, well, would you be open to using a partial profile? And she said she'd entertain a motion to exclude the mitochondrial DNA. So I wasn't sure if this was Lally's way of trying to push things back or push the trial back, but I also found that really interesting. And going back to the buffer zone, I'll point out that the defense took no stance on it. The defense stated that this was between the CW and the Constitution, and they are focused on winning inside the courtroom. So I saw on Twitter, and listen, it's Twitter, so take it for what you will, but some account said something like, remember me, I'm not a troll account. Karen texted Yannetti before 6 a.m. that morning, and it'll come out at trial. And I was like, wait, what? I mean, listen, I don't necessarily believe what I read on Twitter, obviously, but I thought that was worth mentioning because I was like, what is going on? I guess we will find out after the 16th, but going back to the defense's motion to dismiss getting denied, I'm not super surprised, but I think that we just have a lot to talk about with that and with the trial and the case in general. So let's get to my guest this week, Imran Ansari. You have seen Imran anchoring on Law & Crime, and you've seen his commentary on Court TV. But Imran was a Brooklyn prosecutor, and he worked for the Brooklyn DA's office for some time. And now he's a criminal defense attorney at Idala Law. And he will speak about the high-profile cases that he works on. But he represents Curtis Jackson, 50 Cent, Alan Dershowitz, Harvey Weinstein, Ghislaine Maxwell. And so I wanted him to weigh in here with having a perspective on both sides. And this is not an episode where we sit there and argue the facts, because I think that is becoming so tiresome. This is just an episode where you can learn and hear about the inner workings of a prosecutor turned criminal defense attorney. So, with that all being said, here is my interview with Imran Ansari.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imran Ansari, thank you so much for joining me to weigh in on this crazy, crazy case. Now, I reached out to you because you have experience as both a prosecutor. You worked at the Brooklyn DA's office for a very long time, and now you are one of the top criminal defense attorneys in the country. So can you just tell us a few of the cases that you are currently working on right now? You don't have to get into detail or anything, but I just want people to see everything that you're doing and how high profile some of these cases are.
Yeah, Lauren. So we're involved in a few high profile cases with very public high-profile clients, both on the criminal side of things and also the civil side of things here at my firm. Of course, these individuals are often not very popular in the court of public opinion, but we fight for them nonetheless in the court of law. And we represent Harvey Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein is one of my clients. Alan Dershowitz is a client of mine. Ghislaine Maxwell, we handled her appeal. Paul Haggis, who is also a Hollywood director. He was behind Crash and other movies. Oh. I represent 50 Cent, I should say, Curtis Jackson. There's a few more. We have and then not so controversial clients like 50 Cent is not. There's nothing controversial about the cases we represent him on that I'm
not now, but
representing
no,
it on. And then let's see. There's a
you
few
guys,
more.
You repped the Raniers, Keith Raniere.
Right.
Is that
so
right?
Keith,
yeah, that yes. was crazy, crazy case.
Keith Raniere, who is the NXIVM, head of the NXIVM cult, allegedly, is now incarcerated in Arizona in a federal prison there. And we're representing Keith Raniere in a lot of the post-conviction aspects of things. Also, Claire Bronfman, who was also allegedly part of the NXIVM cult, who is currently incarcerated in a federal penitentiary. Also, post-conviction matters we are handling for her. And also civil defense for some civil lawsuits that have come through the pipeline on that. So that's a few of the clients that we have here. I'm sure I'm forgetting some other high profile cases that we have, but there's a few. But we also represent a lot of just everyday people who find themselves in trouble and in a situation that requires criminal defense, but also in civil litigation and lawsuits, both the plaintiff side and the defense side.
Okay. I guess I didn't realize that you do deal with plaintiffs at this point, but I'm thinking back and something Kirk Nurmi had said to me is he said, a lot of the time, criminal defense attorneys, we get a really bad rap, but we're making sure that our clients are entitled to their constitutional rights. So, and I think that is what people want for Karen Reed that believe she is innocent. They want to make sure that she is entitled to all of her constitutional rights.
Right.
So generally speaking, I mean, you really have to wear a different hat as a prosecutor and as a criminal defense attorney. And, you know, I know that there's some obvious answers here, but what are the main differences in your thinking?
Sure. And by the way, Kirk Nurmi is excellent and really love Kirk. And he has a great point. Let me just comment on that really quick, Lauren. The role of a criminal defense attorney is so vital to our justice system and the upholding of a constitutional right or rights of the defendant. And it's often, especially now, and I'm going to cite, you know, my client Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too movement that followed, the criticism for defense attorneys for representing people and individuals who are accused of crimes and who may be lambasted in the court of public opinion. People may be railing against them on social media. That's sometimes for people who don't know better and maybe are not really thinking, then is imputed on the criminal defense attorney, which is completely improper and wrong because we are filling that very vital aspect of the criminal justice system. And I'm going to cite to John Adams, the former president and a founding father who represented the British troops during the aftermath of the Boston Massacre in the Crispus Attucks trial. He was representing the enemy in a sense, but again, in a young America, in a young pre-America, I should say, there was that recognition that it's a vital role, the role of the criminal defense attorney. And people who sometimes lose that, you know, train of thought and start saying, how could you represent these people? They don't really fully understand the need for that until they may find themselves in the defendant's seat or a loved one is accused of a crime. And then, you know, it's a different story. But I had to comment on that. But to get to your question, Lauren, about the two hats, right? Yeah. There are two hats, but they're also very much connected, right? The prosecutor and a criminal defense attorney often find themselves working together in many ways in terms of making sure that, you know, a case is proceeding in the right way before a judge. And also the requirements of a prosecutor is really being held accountable. Karen Reed. Let's talk about Karen Reed because that's why we're here.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting case. You're following it. I'm following it. The latest news on Karen Reed is that those protesters are going to be having their right to be protesting out there. Of course, that's a First Amendment question, a constitutional right for freedom of speech. And that was that issue, right? The prosecutors were trying to get at least some damper on that in fear that there was going to be an effect on the jury and there wouldn't be able to get a fair and impartial jury. But of course, the judge denied that. And now those protesters are going to have their voice. And of course, what's going to happen, Lauren, is the voice of the defendant in the court through their attorney in this case is going to be so important based on the defense that they're bringing, which really is amounting to a conspiracy, right, with law enforcement against Karen Reed. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in court.
Well, yeah, so they did. She ruled a 200 feet buffer zone as of, I think it was yesterday afternoon. So I immediately thought of Derek Chauvin. So I did call his attorney's office this morning because I couldn't find anything to show that these protesters that were holding up signs that Derek Chauvin's a murderer and this and that, that they had to be X many feet away. And he didn't call me back. I can't find it anywhere. But wouldn't that be something on the other side that you would want done? Like, hey, wait a minute. You can't be holding up signs that my client's a murderer. The jury walks in here. You know, the jury walks up these steps. So I don't know if you know anything about that, but it just seems really interesting that on the other side, they're pushing this forward.
Yeah, no, listen, everyone wants a fair and impartial jury, whether you're a prosecutor or a defendant, because, you know, if the defendant is convicted, that's going to just tee up an appeal, right? Mm-hmm. So you may be sitting there as a prosecutor thinking you had a win, but really at the trial, if there's issues like that and there's going to be an argument that it wasn't a fair and impartial jury because there was too much static or noise out there with the protesters, you don't want that necessarily, even if you are Karen Reed's attorneys. I would imagine Karen Reed's attorneys are looking to win this inside that courtroom, not outside, right? And based on that, whether you have someone with a sign saying free Karen Reed or not, that's not going to necessarily get you to the end point of what you need to accomplish in this particular case as a defense attorney.
This is so funny because you didn't even watch the hearing yesterday. I know that because you're way too busy. You literally just said what her attorney said. She said, we want to win this inside the courtroom. That's literally exactly what she said. And they took no position on this. They're like, right. We take no position, whatever you want, you know, we're going to win it inside. So it's really interesting that you say that. Something that has been driving me crazy about this case, and I don't know if you've experienced this, but on the prosecution side and the defense side, they have their experts with the same information saying the complete opposite. And I'm speaking directly about the 2:27 a.m. search. And I'm speaking about, you have a medical examiner that said, there's no way these injuries came from a car, from an automobile, which is interesting right. for a medical examiner to say. And then on the other side, you have I believe it was the feds expert that said, our expert said the 2:27 a.m. search happened. And then the prosecution saying, nope, didn't happen. Celebrate says this. So I'm like, what is the jury supposed to believe?
Yeah, and that's really going to be the jury's job to parse through those experts' testimony and find out what they feel is more credible. I mean, Lauren, you always typically have a battle of the experts, but here, like you mentioned in Karen Reed's case, it's particularly polarized in terms of the findings of both experts. I mean, they're starkly different, but the defense needs that, right? They need an expert to come in and say that the prosecution's theory of the case, the injuries, they're not consistent with that theory and the mechanism that the prosecution is saying happened here in order to get Karen Reed that defense that they are putting out there. And they're putting forward a pretty extreme defense. They're suggesting to this jury that this is a cover-up. That's an extreme defense. That is going to a level as a defendant who has the right to remain silent in court. Even their attorneys don't need to put on a defense, but they're doing so here. It's really, they're going to have to bring the evidence to support that theory themselves. And how do they do that? Well, when you have these experts battling it out that way, it's not only a consideration for the jury on the case in chief, but it's raising reasonable doubt. And as a defense attorney, that's what you want to do. You want to raise reasonable doubt in so many aspects, in as many ways you can. So you could go to that jury at the end of the day and say, let's think about what their expert said, but what did our expert say? Let's think about what the medical examiner that testified for the state said, but what did our expert say about that? And at that point, even pitting those experts against each other, you're raising reasonable doubt. And even if the jury may have a hard time grasping on to this sort of conspiracy theory of a defense that there was a cover-up and law enforcement, they're all in on it, they may still get to the point where they're going to be hung or acquit because they're looking at both expert testimonies and saying, well, you know what? That actually has me scratching my head, and that's reasonable doubt.
Yeah, it's crazy that you also just verbalized kind of how I feel about this, where I've said there's so much reasonable doubt here. And listen, I think it's a strange thing to think about him going inside this house and immediately getting sucker punched. I've said this. However, I still have a hard time believing that she hit him with her car. I really do. So it's mind-blowing to me how I have all these different thoughts and I can't seem to put anything together here in my own head. So,
Lauren, just to briefly interrupt, great point you just said. You, as an attorney, especially as a prosecutor that needs to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, we wouldn't want any jurors in your position. Right? Not having that ability to parse through the evidence or the story and come to a conclusion, because that's going to lead to either an acquittal or a hung jury, right? Because you need the unanimous verdict. So if there was a Lauren Conlin sitting on that jury with the mindset that you just verbalized now, that would be a problem for the prosecution.
And I've said this because someone said to me, oh, well, you could be on the jury because you're open and I'm like, no, I don't think I would be, because I have in my head that I don't think that she hit him, but I also don't think that he got sucker punched walking in the house. I literally don't know. I wasn't there. I'm parsing through this information. And then in turn, you have areas of the investigation where police, in my opinion, did not do the best job here. They did not. And you also have the DA's office, which You know, this is also something super interesting because these witnesses were brought in and all of a sudden D.A. Morrissey came out and I'll read you part of what he said and part of this is why the defense wanted him excluded from this whole thing and the D.A.'s office because he went on the news in August of 2023 and he said this, quote, Jennifer McCabe, Matthew McCabe, Brian Albert. These people were not part of a conspiracy and certainly did not commit murder or any crime that night. They have been forthcoming with authorities, provided statements, have not engaged in any cover-up. They are not suspects in any crime. They are merely witnesses to the case. To have them accused of murder is outrageous. To have them harassed and intimidated based on false narratives and accusations is wrong. They are witnesses. Conspiracy, I'm skipping through, conspiracy theories are not evidence. Michael Proctor, the state police trooper being accused of planting evidence outside 34 Fairview Road, was never at Fairview Road on the day of the incident. Proctor and his state police partner traveled together the entire day while other officers were processing 34 Fairview. Trooper Proctor was there and did not plant evidence at 34 Fairview Road, end quote. He basically says these witnesses to accuse them of murder is outrageous. And this comes after Jennifer McCabe's phone. They found the 2:27 a.m. Google search, how long to die in the cold. Do you find this statement from a prosecutor's office, and this is just part of it, do you find this to be strange? Do you find this to be normal?
I mean, Lauren, you have to think of this, about the situation with this case, right? Mm-hmm. Here you and I are discussing it, you know, and I'm a host on Law and Crime. We've been covering the hearings also, right? So the public is very interested in this case. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of people out there putting forward these theories about what happened, you know, alleging this sort of conspiracy and this cover-up. So as a prosecutor, now I'm putting my prosecutor hat back on, you want to quiet that noise to some extent. Mm-hmm. Typically, prosecutors don't really comment too much about cases that are ongoing. You normally get a comment from a prosecutor in the beginning, let's just say when an arrest has been made and charges brought, they may issue a press release, or at the end of the case, typically after a conviction, a press statement like that. But during the course of pendency of a case, prosecutors don't typically make any comments, but I think they felt the need to do so in an attempt to quiet some of the other, you know, theories that are percolating out there. Right. And of course, ultimately, Lauren, it's going to be what the prosecution brings into that courtroom by way of evidence to refute any of this defense that is coming forward by the defendant and also out there in the court of public opinion. But really in that court of law, it's going to count what evidence they have, the testimony, matching up the injuries to the mechanism they say caused the death. And if they're able to do that, then all the other theories are going to go to the wayside and they're going to have a conviction on their hand, right? But, you know, it's to me to issue a statement like that in this case is unique, but it's also a unique case where you have a lot of chatter out there. You have a lot of people out there sort of being what I call armchair jurors, where they're speculating about things and they're drumming up all these sort of theories. So the prosecution maybe had said, you know, in their press office, what have you, we need to get out ahead of this a little to try to get our voice out there and our spin on what's going on out to the public.
Yeah, so it is unique, but like you said, it's a very unique case here. So would this be a problem for you? One of the witnesses, he's an ATF agent, Brian Higgins. He allegedly has an office at the Canton Police Department. And he's part of this whole thing is he was at the house that night. He was hanging out with them. He allegedly had a relationship with Karen Reed. I mean, if you're a defense attorney, would he be a problem as a witness?
In terms of a helpful witness to the prosecution or
exactly. They're claiming that he lied to the grand jury. There's all these allegations going on that, you know, it's a little crazy, but.
Well, Lauren, if he has information and testimony that's helpful to the prosecution that you just mentioned, maybe the prosecution wants to bring certain aspects of that out, then he's also ripe for cross-examination. So if there was any inconsistencies or there's credibility issues that are going to be pointed out by the defense with this witness, the prosecution calls him to the stand, then he's going to be up there for cross-examination. And if there was any untruths or inconsistencies with the grand jury testimony, you know a defense attorney is going to be taking that transcript and they're going to be grilling that witness on that prior inconsistent statement or fallacy in the testimony. And then a witness that may be helpful for the prosecution may end up being harmful for the prosecution. That's why when you're a trial attorney, no matter what side you're on, you better make sure that you're calling a witness that you feel, even if they have helpful testimony, that on cross-examination, you're going to see all that helpful testimony being undone by way of a artful or strategic cross-examination. So you got to be careful with your witness choices. And the prosecution here, if there is a troubling piece of information that the defense may capitalize on, they may think twice about calling him if he doesn't move the ball forward in a necessary way to that conviction.
You make such a good point. It's almost like it doesn't matter who your witnesses are because they will be cross-examined. And if there are any holes, I'm assuming the defense will find them and they absolutely jump on them. So, you know, that just, I'm going to skip through some of my other questions because you pretty much answered it right there with that. So do you think the buffer zone, in your opinion, do you think it's unconstitutional keeping them 200 feet away?
Yeah, no, I think a buffer zone is a discretionary decision by the judge here where she's weighing the First Amendment rights and constitutional rights of the protesters while also in considering that she needs to maintain her courtroom and her courthouse, so to say, in a proper decorum. And you don't want any distractions. As a judge in a jury trial, you're sitting up there and you're basically maintaining order in the courtroom, right? Yeah. You're making sure that, you know, evidence is coming in properly. You're ruling on objections to make sure that evidence or testimony that is objectionable and the jury should not hear is excluded or kept out. And you're making sure that the trial goes smoothly in the sense that the jurors are sitting there and they're maintaining their fairness and impartiality during the course of the trial as they're receiving the evidence until they have a moment to consider that evidence and deliberate and render their verdict. So I think the buffer zone was sort of splitting the baby here, saying there's an absolute constitutional First Amendment right to free speech and to people to protest outside a public outside a courthouse in a public trial. But also, I don't want any interference in the way that I'm going to have a problem with my trial, where I may have a mistrial in the middle of receiving evidence. I may have a appeal if the defendant is convicted based on a decision I made because I didn't consider that these protesters may rise to the level of being interfering with this trial to a problematic degree. So I think the buffer zone was speaking to her recognition of the First Amendment while also saying, I'm going to still maintain order in my courtroom.
Okay. All right. And then I guess the communication between Karen Reed and the journalist Turtle Boy, Aidan Carney, I'm sure you've heard about this. Now, do you think this communication, and he has covered this case from the start, do you think this type of communication will be brought up at trial? Will it matter? Will it affect anything that he was charged with witness intimidation? I guess on her behalf, so to speak, because these witnesses were, you know, part of her case. What do you think about that?
Well, so it's a slippery slope for the prosecution, right? Like on one hand, you may want to bring up that the defendant has engaged in certain behavior that a defendant really should not do, or you wouldn't expect a typical defendant to do. And maybe that could somehow score a point with the jury. But then again, you're fighting hard as a prosecutor to keep all that extraneous press and blogging and conspiracy out, right? So if you raise that in any way, and you let that come into that courtroom by way of you asking a question or offering a document or something like that, then you've opened the door, arguably, right? And then if you have worked pretty hard with pre-trial motions like motions in limine to keep certain things out of that courtroom, dealing with these conspiracy theories or things like that, or comments by other third parties who have nothing to do with the trial, then you may undo that because you've opened the door. Now the defense could say, well, we have the right to comment on that. We have a right to call a witness now to comment on what the prosecution has brought in as evidence. So I would expect all that other, the communications with this blogger or, journalist would be kept out by the prosecution. Whether the defendant wants to bring it in, I think it would be somewhat extrajudicial, extraneous.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Earthquake in New York.
Yeah, I know. I know. Is that so funny? My phone was going off like crazy too. And sorry, I'll wrap this up because I know you were very busy. But I'm just curious. So, do you think that there could possibly be some big bombshell dropped on either side? And I don't know, obviously, I don't know the law as well as I probably could, but do they have to present everything to Cannoni before? Do they have to, hey, we have this, we have that, or could they drop something that everybody is like, whoa, what the hell is that? Or what? I didn't know anything about that.
Sure. So, let me differentiate between state trials, state courts, right? And I'm not a practitioner in Massachusetts, but I'm going to speak from a New York standpoint, right?
Okay.
And I'm sure Massachusetts has a similar state sort of practice. Mm-hmm. State versus federal. In federal court, when you're going to trial, you typically exchange all your exhibits, you give your witness lists. You go into that court pretty much knowing what evidence your adversary is going to present,
unless
it's for impeachment purposes, right?
Sorry, did you say federal or state? I'm just making
federal,
sure.
Federal.
Federal. I'm sorry. Okay,
yep.
Federal.
Yep, federal. You kind of know what exhibits to expect, what your adversary is going to put into evidence or try to put into evidence, unless it's for impeachment material, right? That's a carve out. You don't need to show your hand if you have something and you expect the witness to testify in a certain way and you want to impeach them on something, right?
Yeah.
In state court, it's a little less, it's more relaxed. You don't necessarily have to show the other side every piece of evidence that you intend to present unless you have to exchange it in discovery, right? So in discovery, you typically exchange the materials and the other side could say, well, undue surprise, we didn't receive this, Your Honor, in discovery and could get it excluded. But if you have a piece of material, again, for impeachment, right, you have more leeway to bring that evidence, a bombshell document and whatnot, if you can articulate to the judge that we didn't need to disclose this previously because we were going to use it for impeachment purposes. Now, federal court is very strict. State court tends to be more relaxed, although you still need to exchange things in discovery. If there's some piece of evidence, material that either side has for impeachment purposes, of course, the prosecution has Brady obligations, in order to provide the defendant with pretty much all the discovery. But mm-hmm. if there's impeachment material that you want to hold back, it could lead itself or lend itself to a bombshell moment in court, but it would have to be sort of carved out in that exception.
Okay, because I believe there are still some records sealed by the defense. So I wasn't sure if maybe there was something in there that they were holding off on telling the public until trial. And
right.
I know that I shouldn't pay attention to Twitter, but somebody wrote something, oh, this certain text is going to come out at trial and you're all going to see, and I'm like, is that possible that it's the first we've all heard of it?
Right. So Lauren, that's a different sort of question, right? Like, that's not withholding material from the other side. So I imagine the whatever you're talking about may be under seal, right? The text messages or some material
sure.
under seal.
Yeah.
The prosecution already knows about that, right? It's just right. sealed from the public.
Right.
Now you go forward with a trial. A lot of times all that, the level of protection under a protective order or court sealing is undone, right? Mm. Because now it's been sealed during the pendency of pretrial procedures and discovery. But at trial, it's an open book typically. And the public gets to see the evidence that is being presented in court. So the defense may have a document that they have and they're holding ready, to present at trial that we may get to see once the trial occurs.
Do you think that this is going to be a long, drawn-out trial?
I mean, it all depends on the level and extent of evidence that we're going to see from the prosecution. And of course, then what the defense is going to be putting on after this theory that they have put forward, and you know, the defense are going to be putting on a case. I'm not sure how long or drawn out it can be or would be. It's sort of a finite incident and occurrence. But if the defense really wants to make a fleshed out case on their side to support this conspiracy argument that they want to put before the jury, you may see a longer trial. And then again, we have to be cognizant, based on all the theories out there in the public, the blogging, the, you know, podcast, the coverage on mainstream media. Yeah. You got to be careful in a situation like this, that, you know, you don't end up with some sort of mistrial in the middle of the trial because some of the fears that we hear about in court. A juror read something, saw something, you know, was contacted by someone out there. You know, you don't know. I'm sure the jury is going to be very protected in this case because you don't want them to be influenced by all the things out there.
I was going to say, I mean, I think everybody covering this has bias. I think Court TV has a lot of bias that she's guilty. And that's fine, because I don't think that anybody reports anymore without an opinion. That's just not what we do. So I completely get that. The last thing I was going to ask you, do you think it, and I don't know if you would necessarily do this as a criminal defense attorney, do you think it was smart that Alan Jackson and Karen Reed went on Nightline?
I'll tell you, as a criminal defense attorney, I would say 99% of the time, tell my client, you're not going to make a public statement, right? So we've talked about some of the high profile clients that I represent or have represented. And there's been a few who really, because they were on top and they were in the public eye, really wanted to go out there and make statements to the media and get their story out there, because they felt that there was a huge pylon in the press and the media on them. And no matter, you know, what, we control the statement. I will give a statement out there as attorney, which is crafted and controlled. Because again, in public cases like this, there's the court of public opinion, but ultimately what matters is winning in the court of law. And you don't want to do anything that's going to jeopardize that. So I would say yes. As a defense attorney, I would probably dissuade my client, no matter what, of going forward on Nightline or talking to any press and giving interviews, because of the potential damage it could do. You never know what other sort of statements may come out there that could be seen as contradictory. So I would always hang back, put the state to the burden, and then, you know, duke it out in court.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, because then they're going to start comparing everything you've said to the media and so on. And it was Alan Jackson who was the one that made me scratch my head in the Nightline interview, who literally stated John walked in the house and got sucker punched. And I'm like, wait, is that okay? I'm very anxious to see the outcome of this. My civilian opinion here is that there's a lot of reasonable doubt, and whether or not they can prove she hit him or did not hit him, or there is a conspiracy with all these people, I just think it's too difficult to prove either one at this point. Right. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. And, you know, Lauren, the defense theory, I mean, it's a hard pill to swallow. Coming from, you know, the mindset of the law, whether you're a prosecutor or even a criminal defense attorney, you're looking and you're like, that's a bold accusation there, right? You know,
a lot of people.
You better back that up in court. But then the prosecution, remember, their burden is beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they're successful by the theory that they're putting out there, the defense, just to even raise some reasonable doubt, and a juror may walk away from this and say, you know what, I think she hit him, but the prosecution didn't convince me beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
And, you know, because of that, I couldn't convict. Right. So, you know, you may end up with that. And then if the defense, even if those jurors aren't buying it, their theory, but they still think, well, now I can't convict though, because I'm not sure. And you get even just one juror to get to that point, you have a hung jury, right? And that may even lead to an acquittal if you have, you know, if you're able to get all of them to get on that bandwagon, you know? So that's, in many ways, sometimes for a defense attorney, an acquittal is the ultimate win. but a hung jury is also looked at as a win too.
And I think about this, and it actually makes me sick to my stomach for Officer O'Keefe's family, because I do not feel that they are going, I mean, not that they will ever be the same after this, but
yeah. And you know, you sometimes take a step back and you think about, you know, what are we, there's the theories going on for the defense. We're looking at the prosecution. Like, what is the prosecution doing? You see like the protesters, but let's take a step back and think about his family, O'Keefe's family, you know, his niece, right? He was taking care of his niece.
And his nephew,
And his nephew. I mean, you know, there's a lot of loss here. And think about those two children who lost their parents, and he took that on and was basically raising them and taking care of them. I mean, there's a lot of tragedy here. And I hope at least there's some closure for his family. And even if we walk away from this trial with a lot of people still disagreeing with whatever the verdict may be, there's some closure and peace of mind for his family.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm just not sure that's going to happen, but I really do hope and pray. But Imran Ansari, thank you so much. I'm going to plug all of your socials, where people can find you, where they can retain you if you have time ever, if they're in trouble or whatever. But thank you so much again. I really, really always appreciate your insight.
Lauren, thank you for having me. You're awesome at what you do. You're a friend. So it's a pleasure being on with you.
Okay, that was Imran Ansari, defense attorney for Idala Law. And I put in the notes section everywhere that you can find him. And yes, he mentioned he is an anchor on Law and Crime. He's awesome. I really do enjoy listening to him. And I was really happy that he came at this case from somewhat of a general perspective, because that's what I wanted here. Again, I'm so sick of people arguing the facts, because that's clearly getting nowhere, literally, absolutely nowhere. So I'm anxious for April 16th, as I know many of you are as well. So thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, don't forget to rate and subscribe on Apple or wherever you listen. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.